Is America a Christian nation? If so, how should Christianity influence politics and public policy today? Hi, I'm Richard Nelson, founder and executive director of the Commonwealth Policy Center, and you're joining The Commonwealth Matters. Joining us to talk further and to help us answer these questions is Dr. Mark David Hall, professor at Regent University's Robertson School of Government. Dr. Hall is the author of the books, Did America Have a Christian Founding? And also the book, Proclaim Liberty Throughout All the Land. Dr. Hall, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Richard. It's great to be here.
Hey, this is two important books that you've written that help us to better understand, first of all, America's founding fathers and what they actually believed. By the way, just a note to all those who are tuned in, I'm an alum of Regent University, graduated in 1995, and it's great to have a professor at Regent University joining us. And Dr. Hall, I remember back then, we were discussing the same things that we're talking about right now in this program, is to what extent were the founding fathers Christian? Because the reality is that I would say that the prevailing opinion of historians is that they were deists, that they were strongly influenced by the Enlightenment, that maybe they were Christian in name, but they certainly did not believe tenets of Orthodox Christianity. So let's talk about that for starters. And you challenge these arguments that the founding fathers were deists. What were the religious convictions of most of the founding fathers?
Well, first of all, let me say you're exactly right in your portrayal of the literature. Book after book asserts that most or many of America's founders were deists. A deist, of course, is a rational approach to religion that basically removes all the things perceived to be as irrational, the atonement, the Trinity, miracles. And so deists tend to believe in a creator God who maybe likes good and doesn't like evil, and maybe there's an afterlife, but not distinctively Christian. If that's our definition of deist, I argue in the book that maybe two of the founders are accurately labeled deist, and one of those, Thomas Paine, isn't really even an American, right? He's from England. He spends most of his life in Europe. After he writes The Age of Reason, which is very much a deistic tract, he came back to America, and almost nobody wanted to have anything to do with him because of these heretical views. Ethan Allen is basically the only homegrown deist. So book after book makes this assertion, and what they always do is they focus in on five or six founders, a Thomas Jefferson, a James Madison, a John Adams, a George Washington, and Alexander Hamilton, and a handful of others. And certainly you're able to show that some of these founders are not Orthodox Christians, a Thomas Jefferson, a John Adams, for sure. Ben Franklin as a young man, certainly. And yet when you turn to other founders, like a George Washington, a Alexander Hamilton, there's actually no good reason to believe that they aren't Orthodox Christians. And when you turn your eyes from these elites to the broader political class, I'm not talking about peasants in the field, but the sort of people serving in the Continental Congress, the state legislatures, debating the ratification of the Constitution, there's every reason to believe that most of them were Orthodox Christians. And, you know, we could discuss their denominational makeup and that sort of thing. There's some distinctions. But 98% of Americans of European descent are Protestant, 2% Roman Catholic, about 1,500 Jews in four or five American cities. So an overwhelmingly Christian people.
Yeah. In fact, in your book, you say that there were only three of the founding fathers that publicly questioned some aspects of Orthodox Christianity. You mentioned Thomas Paine, Ethan Allen, and Benjamin Franklin as well, who his views evolved. And just like all of us, we change in our views. We grow in understanding. I'm thinking of the Christian journey where we start out, we have a starting point where we embrace faith, and then we grow in the faith. We learn more. We have influences in our lives. And I think perhaps this is the case with Franklin as well, who was a fan of George Whitefield. He would attend Whitefield's open-air sermons when he would come and preach, and I believe in Philadelphia. So Franklin, who knows, maybe he did embrace Orthodox Christianity at some point in his life. But it's fascinating that many historians, and many prominent historians, by the way, you quote some of their statements, many prominent historians take the views of the handful, maybe a half dozen of the founding fathers, and they extrapolate them, those views on the rest of them. And what do we have? In the Declaration of Independence, there were 55 signers. And so to take a half dozen and extrapolate that on the rest, that's not very good history, is it? It's not a very good historical analysis, is it?
No, that's very right. And you think about some of these founders that are commonly looked at, they are very unrepresentative of the broader political class. So Ben Franklin spent literally half of the last 30 years of his life in Europe. Thomas Jefferson spent significant time in Europe. John Adams, significant time in Europe. Most of the founders usually looked at are Anglicans, members of the Church of England, and only about 15% of Americans are members of the Church of England. 50 to 75% are Calvinists, and John Adams is the only founder that is usually looked at who fits into that broadly into that denominational tradition. Now, don't get me wrong. I clearly acknowledge in the book that an Adams, a Franklin, a Jefferson are not Orthodox Christians, but an important part of the argument is they are not representative of the political class. It would be similar to someone mentioning 3, 4, or 5 African-American Republicans and then concluding that most African-Americans are Republicans. It's just a ridiculous claim.
Yeah, very good. You contend in your book, Mark, that the Holy Scriptures were the most important source of authority for America's founding fathers, but also that the Scriptures were not a handbook of politics. So where do you come up with this? That's a radical statement in itself, that it's the most important source of authority for the founding fathers. Let's start there. Where do you come up with that statement?
Well, first of all, we just know it to be the case. My friend Daniel Dreisbach has an excellent book, Reading the Bible with the Founding Fathers, where he shows the founders just were thoroughly familiar with Scripture, routinely weaving it into their public and private publications, letters, and this sort of thing, and that they, upon occasion, explicitly drew from it. So the Continental Army, for instance, limited the number of times a soldier could be whipped to 39. George Washington wanted to increase that to like 300. And Roger Sherman, that old Puritan from Connecticut, objected based on the Levitical law that, of course, says that no one can be whipped more than 40 times. And the Jewish scholars, the rabbis, of course, limited that to 39 times to make sure you don't go over 40. So that's a very specific example, but not really an interesting example. I think far more important is the founders were convinced to a person that humans are created in the imago Dei, the image of God, and therefore should be treated with respect and dignity. And yet they also recognize that humans are fallen, right? Madison in Federalist 51, if men were angels, government wouldn't be necessary. But men aren't angels. And even Christians continue to struggle with the old man within. Everyone knew this. And this is why they adopted a constitutional order with separation of powers, checks and balances, federalism, whereas Enlightenment political thought is going exactly the opposite direction. Let's have a strong, centralized national government run by the experts. America's founders would have nothing to do with that sort of approach to government because of their Christian convictions.
The founding fathers also realized that the Bible was not necessarily a handbook of politics, even though biblical principles were derived from it and applied to political issues, contemporary issues of the day. The founding fathers looked at other philosophers. John Locke, for example, was very influential. So they did look to others. How would you address those critics who say, well, look, they were quoting Locke or they were looking at Montesquieu and these others?
Well, first of all, we have to recognize that the Bible was by far and away the most cited text in the political literature of the American founding, to say nothing of other literature. So a fellow named Donald Lutz did an excellent study where he went through a bunch of political pamphlets, narrowed down these pamphlets to about 700 and some, and then he just simply counted up citations. And what he found is that something like 32% of them are to the Bible, 20% are to all Enlightenment authors combined. So that would certainly include a John Locke, Montesquieu, Adam Smith, Beccaria, all of them combined are only 20%. And he profoundly undercounts references to the Bible because the founders were always weaving biblical text into their letters and pronouncements and this sort of thing. And he literally is looking for citations. So for instance, George Washington weaves Micah 4:4 into letters and speeches more than 40 times, and yet he never puts a little parenthetical citation, Micah 4:4, after it. And so many scholars have just simply missed this, and they've said stupid things, like there's no evidence that Washington ever read his Bible or cited it, whereas he quotes it literally all the time. And so the Bible is part and parcel of every political debate you can imagine. But the Bible, you know, it teaches us that humans are created in the imago Dei. It teaches us how that humans are fallen, but it doesn't teach us how to put together a constitutional order. And so when we're thinking about, okay, what should this constitutional order look like? They certainly look to someone like Montesquieu, who's an early advocate of separation of powers and explaining how we have to take the different power, the executive power, legislative power, judicial power, and separate it from each other. And so they certainly look to him to address a profoundly Christian problem, fallen human nature. And yeah, so they look at and cite, and Jefferson in the Declaration actually quotes John Locke, but this shouldn't surprise us. I bet if they look, you have a book coming out, I bet if I look at that book, I'm going to see citations to things other than the Bible. It doesn't mean you aren't profoundly influenced by your Christian faith when it comes to politics.
So you say in your book, Mark, that the founding fathers drew from their Christian convictions to create a constitutional order that benefits all Americans and not just Christians. And these convictions, these Christian biblical principles, led them to limit things like federal power. They valued checks and balances within the government. They supported the rule of law. They protected a robust concept of religious liberty, these kind of things. So are these things, are you suggesting that when they were dialoguing and writing letters back and forth and doing official proceedings, were they referencing biblical principles that pointed to these things, like checks and balances? Could you argue that it's because of what the inherent sinfulness of man that you should not have concentrated power, right? Can that be documented historically? As a historian, that's what you are. Can we point to biblical references that link to these important American principles?
Yeah, sometimes you can, for sure. So I mentioned Federalist 51, if men were angels, government wouldn't be necessary. And that's not quoting a Bible verse, but everyone would understand exactly what Madison is talking about there. And so, yeah, sometimes it's just a background assumption, fallen human nature. Sometimes there's explicit reference to biblical text. Franklin referenced a specific biblical text in the Constitutional Convention to explain why basically those serving in Congress shouldn't be paid. So, yeah, it definitely is there. I think, again, I'll say that because oftentimes the founders would quote the Bible without citation, it's missed. And so if you really need to know your Bible well, and you can pick up on these things.
The founding fathers contended that religion and morality are necessary for Republican government. For example, people need to respect one another. They need to treat each other with dignity. They need to tell the truth. And that ultimately these ideas come from religion. This is the source of truth, right? This the source of what's right and wrong. And also that people need internal controls in order to have maximum freedom. But Mark, we've lost this idea today where we are, as a people, as a whole, we're ignorant of the kind of government we have, a Republican form of government, but also the idea of where do values come from? What is the source of truth? Is there, and there's such polarization. Look, if you enter the public arena in many cases and identify as a Christian, or if you say that there is a higher authority, that there's a God who determines right and wrong, a God who determines gender, right? That's a controversial statement today. And there's so much polarization, and then there's canceling today. My question is, where do we as Christians begin to reengage this conversation? The idea that religion and morality are necessary for Republican government, and in order to have maximum freedom, we need to have internal controls, right? So the founding fathers understood. In fact, I think it was George Washington who said in his second inaugural that religion and morality are indispensable supports to our government. The beliefs of the founding fathers are foreign to us today. I know there's a lot there that I just put out there, but where do we as Christians begin this conversation linking religion and morality to a stable and continuing Republican form of government?
Yeah, so you're exactly right. This was Jim Hudson of the Library of Congress calls this a founder syllogism, that you must have a moral people if you're going to have a Republican form of government, and that you must have a religious people if you're going to have a moral people. And indisputably, in the founding era, everyone assumes by religion, we mean Christianity. the quote you gave is from the farewell address. And I say that not to correct you, but just to point your readers and listeners there, because Washington goes on to say an amazingly controversial thing. It'd be controversial today. He basically says, in vain would that man claim the title of patriot if he undermines religion and morality. So if you're out there, if you're a public atheist trying to undermine religion, you're unpatriotic. That's how serious Washington took this. And so the founders didn't rely upon morality. That's why we have separation of powers, checks and balances, and that sort of thing. Madison in Federalist 10 actually says we can't rely on virtue and morality. But still, even Madison would say it certainly makes things run a lot more smoothly if we have it. And so as Christians thinking about where we are today, only about 64% of Americans identify as Christians. Probably no more than half of those go to church with any regularity at all. And it maybe shouldn't come as a surprise then that our politics is so incredibly divisive. And sometimes this division comes from Christians. I'm not suggesting because you're a Christian, you're going to be a virtuous, moral person. Sometimes we let our anger get away with us and act in a vicious fashion. So I think number one, we have to pray for revival. We have to pray that men and women, boys and girls will come to a saving faith in Jesus Christ. That would be great. The church probably needs to do a better job of catechizing its members to make it clear that we must always treat others with respect and dignity, even if we very much disagree with their political positions. There's no need for name-calling or canceling on our part. And then I think we have to work within the system as best we can. But, you know, the first thing we can do is, again, praying for the revival. Second of all, trying to control ourselves and hopefully over time, you know, there have been rough patches in American politics before. The election of 1800 was about as nasty as we've ever seen. And so, you know, I think we can recover from where we are today.
We are going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. Hi, my name is Richard Nelson, founder and executive director of the Commonwealth Policy Center. We're here to shore up the sanctity of human life, religious freedom, natural marriage, and sound fiscal policies. At the Commonwealth Matters, we have conversations with leading thinkers and policymakers to help us think biblically about the great issues of the day. If you appreciate our work, then please consider a donation today. This work is entirely supported by people just like you. Your gifts and tax-deductible contributions help to underwrite this program, and you help to get this important message out all across the Commonwealth. We believe that the Commonwealth of Kentucky is a great place to live, and we want to keep it that way for our families and our children. That's why we're standing for what's right, for what's good, and what's true right here in Kentucky. Thanks in advance for your support, and may God bless you. If you are just joining us, you are tuned in to the Commonwealth Matters. I'm Richard Nelson, your host, here with Mark David Hall, professor at the Robertson School of Government at Regent University. Is America a Christian nation? According to many historians, the answer is no. However, according to Dr. Hall, we need to revisit what the Founding Fathers actually said, what they wrote in their letters to one another, and look at the principles that influenced them as they shaped this country. So, Mark, let's look at the religious context of the founding era. Nine of the colonies had established churches. Many of them in their constitutions had biblical texts that supported certain policies or laws that they had there. In fact, I think every one of them required you to be a Christian in order to hold public office. Yet, when the U.S. Constitution was written, it prohibited any religious test to hold federal office. The First Amendment provided religious freedom for citizens to practice all whatever religious conviction they had. So it's clear just by those two things in what the Constitution says, prohibition of a religious test and the First Amendment freedoms to practice religion without federal government interference. So it seems to be that we're not explicitly a Christian nation. Is that correct in saying that?
One of the things I do in the beginning of Did America Have a Christian Founding is, first of all, I consider what a Christian founding would look like. But then I also consider the question, when was America founded? One could argue that we were founded with our earliest colonial settlements. And if that's what you mean by our founding, then what you said is exactly right. You have law codes with scriptural defenses. You have prohibitions on Quakers and Jesuits. You just can't even come into the colony. You have religious tests for office. fortunately, what we see over the 17th and into the 18th century is a growing understanding of the importance of religious toleration and then eventually religious liberty. And so colonies started voluntarily repealing these prohibitions, even going out of their way to accommodate Quakers, to allow them not to serve in the militia, for instance. And instead, they could do non-military type work or pay for a substitute. They permitted the founders to affirm, or permitted Quakers to affirm rather than swear oaths. So by the time you get to the late 18th century, I think you really do have a much more robust understanding of religious liberty and religious equality. And it seems to me that I have a similar view today as a very sincere practicing Christian. And so I think they came, and I argue in the book, both books actually, that they came to these conclusions for religious reasons. And so they went out of their way to make it crystal clear that individuals from any religion should be free to practice a religion and act upon their religious beliefs whenever possible. That's why Article 6 of the Constitution bans religious tests for office. You're exactly right. Most states, even in 1787, still had religious tests for office, but states are voluntarily getting rid of them as we get into the late 18th into the 19th century. And sometimes they ignore them. There was an American Jew, Henry Jacob, who got elected to the North Carolina legislature in 1808. North Carolina clearly had a religious test that required one to be a Christian. He's Jewish. They let him serve anyway. And appropriately so, right? I think we can recognize that all Americans should be free to act upon their religious convictions and live according to them whenever possible. I'll stop there and you can follow up however you want.
No, that's good. I think that's good. By the way, North Carolina still forbids atheists from holding public office. It's on the books. I think it's part of their constitution. However, it's not enforceable because of a U.S. Supreme Court ruling in 1961 that struck that down. I think something that's important to point out here is that just because you are a Christian, maybe a Christian office holder, doesn't mean that you're going to be a good political leader. In fact, you could be a horrible leader. You could even be a very bad Christian. And you could be a non-Christian and hold public office and be very capable and work for the goodwill and the betterment of your community or your state. Now, as Christians, and I'm saying that just as a point of contrast there, just because you're a Christian doesn't mean you're going to be a great political leader or even a good political leader. But as Christians who believe in toleration, if that's the word, rights of conscience, we do not believe that somebody should be coerced to adhere to the Christian faith. We give birth for other people's conscience and their religious convictions, but also they have the opportunity to serve in office as well. This does not minimize, Mark, your and I's Christian convictions, the importance of somebody to have a relationship with Jesus Christ. But I think that this is important to talk about in a day and age that's highly polarized. And I see great pushback from those in the Christian community. There's some influential voices that are saying, look, only Christians should hold public office. And I'm getting into this Christian nationalism. There's a fairly recent term. It's only been around for a few years. But there was an influential book that came out a year or so ago by Stephen Wolfe, A Case for Christian Nationalism. He's making that case that only Christians should hold public office, that Christian citizens should actually have superior citizen rights to non-Christians. And there's some other troubling aspects there as well. And I know I'm kind of getting ahead of, maybe ahead of this conversation, but even ahead of a book that you just wrote on Christian nationalism. Give us a snapshot of what is your view of Christian nationalism as it's defined by the Stephen Wolfes and others in that camp?
Sure. So it will come out next Tuesday, April the 2nd. The title is Who's Afraid of Christian Nationalism? So if I can take a little bit of a step back, prior to 2006, almost no one is calling himself a Christian nationalist or criticizing Christian nationalism. Beginning in 2006, what you did is you have the beginning of a polemical string of books decrying the rise of Christian nationalism. There are these Christian theocrats out there who want to take over America and oppress literally everyone except for white Christian men and maybe white Protestant men, right? And so ridiculous book after ridiculous book keeps making this argument. in around 2019, scholars started getting involved, and I don't think they're as ridiculous or as polemical. I'm thinking of Whitehead and Perry, Taking America Back for God, but fundamentally flawed books purporting to show that 51.9% of Americans are fully or partially embracing this racist, sexist, militarist, toxic stew of Christian nationalism. So I think this literature is ridiculous, and I spend two chapters being very, very critical of it. Now, what blows my mind is after this term has only been used as a slur for over a dozen years, 2022, of course, some Christians come out and say, aha, we are Christian nationalists. Marjorie Taylor Greene, Stephen Wolfe, Torben Isker. Torben Isker's pamphlet is really very ridiculous. Stephen Wolfe's book is a very serious book of political theology. It's dense. It's worth reading. I disagree with it profoundly, and I've reviewed it twice, and I make a number of arguments where I think he goes astray. If I can just focus in on an area of his book where he drew from my scholarship pretty positively, the American founding, in effect, Wolfe argues that the 17th century Reformed or Calvinist political theologians got everything right. Now, I'm pretty Reformed in my own theology, but what I point out is the Reformed tradition evolves. And by the time you get to the late 18th century, they're rejecting a lot of what had come before. To give just one obvious example, when the Presbyterians revised the Westminster Confession of Faith in 1788, they removed government from calling synods, from calling church synods, and from judging church synods. They just said, look, the government has no role in this. This is a business of the church. Stephen Wolfe, on the other hand, would have a Christian prince, and I think he literally means a prince, calling church synods and judging their outcomes and punishing lazy ministers, all things that I think are just horribly inappropriate, even though if some 17th century Calvinists might have approved them. By the time we get to the late 18th century, even very serious Calvinists have come to the conclusion that these are bad ideas, as are religious tests for office, as are established churches. They came to recognize what I think is definitely the case. When governments run churches, this is always bad for the church. We need to get the government out of the business of running churches and let the church be free to be the church. So they had come to these conclusions, and I think these are very good conclusions. And of course, the Reformed tradition has continued to evolve, mostly in good ways, but I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's all good, Mark. We clearly, there are two distinct arenas. You have church, you have state. When you conflate the obligations and role of the church with that of the state, there are problems. And this is what history has shown us time and again, in Europe especially, but even in the colonies, where there was oppression of certain religious denominations. You had punishment. One denomination that was the state-sponsored church would punish those who were not part of that denomination. And the problem with it is that it coerced, it bullied, it did not respect the rights of conscience, which is part of being made in the image of God, is that God gives us a mind and a conscience. And for the state to bully and coerce because of somebody's religious convictions. And again, keep in mind, this was Christian on Christian coercion and bullying. Some were punished, some were jailed, fined, whipped. That was problematic. And I think it became clear to a good number of people by the time of the founding era. And I want to bring us back to that, that to have the state conflate itself with the church and the role of the church is not a good thing, not a positive development. Mark, I want to move to another area of Christian thought, an important area when it comes to the relationship between law and liberty. We're a nation of laws. The founding fathers believed in the rule of law, but they also believed in individual liberty. They believed that people should have maximum liberty, but not libertinism and not licentiousness, do whatever you want to do. They realized that that would lead to destruction in society, to chaos in society. But the founding fathers had a good understanding of the relationship between law and liberty. In fact, James Wilson, a very influential founding father, said that without liberty, law becomes oppressive. And without law, liberty becomes licentiousness. We've got no concept of this today, when there are no, it seems, moral guardrails in society. And I use it as an example, what our children are exposed to. We've got this debate going on about what's appropriate in our public schools. should children have access to pornographic books or books that promote homosexuality or new gender ideologies? And people are saying, look, this is a freedom issue. It's a liberty issue. And if you are opposed to this, you are oppressive. You are trying to ban books. I think that's a fair place to look at this, the distinction between law and liberty. We're dealing with a little different category because there are children involved, and children are a special category of citizens where we protect them in other regards. But take that example into the larger public arena, and there's that tension. You're either all for liberty, all for people doing what they want, and if not, you're oppressive. So, Mark, how do you address that? How do we address that today? The founding fathers understood that, the relationship between law and liberty. How do we as Christians approach this today?
Yeah, well, first of all, let me just affirm the way you laid it out is exactly right. The founders, I think to a person of which I'm aware, understood liberty as a freedom to do what is right. So to talk to any founder about, I'm free to commit adultery, I'm free to curse in public, I'm free to publish pornography, they would say, no, you aren't. Those are all wrong things. You are not free to do that at all. And this is reflected, say, in the common law. The pornography is illegal. Pornography is that which has a tendency to corrupt the most vulnerable members of society. And so actually a lot of works that probably you and I have on our bookshelves might be considered pornographic under this late 18th century understanding of the term. So, blasphemy laws remain in place. They remain enforced into the 19th century, all sorts of restrictions on speech, some of which I would say are imprudent. And so, of course, we've evolved in especially our legal understanding of liberty with respect to freedom of speech and that sort of thing. And generally, I think Christians benefit from this broad understanding of freedom of speech, of freedom to act. And if the state got in the business of restricting speech, it's highly likely that in many states it would be restricting conservative speech or Christian speech. So I'm a pretty big free speech guy. But still, we need to recognize that our freedom to act should be limited by law. I've been speaking about statutory law by and large, but obviously by moral law. The fact that I'm free to curse in public at my opponent doesn't mean I should do so. It is still wrong to do so. And as a Christian, I should constrain myself. And really, all citizens, Christian or not, should constrain themselves.
Yeah, no, that's good. I want to talk about George Washington, one of the most significant founding fathers. Fairly quiet demeanor, interesting character, very thoughtful. I want to talk about his thought about government coercion when it came to religious freedom. So he wrote a letter while president to a Hebrew congregation in 1790 and said that the government of the United States gives bigotry no sanction, to persecution no assistance. It requires only that they who live under its protection should demean themselves as good citizens and give their government their effectual support. The reason I point out this, by the way, in that letter, he references scripture, I think, 8 or 9 times. He quotes the Bible when he's writing to this Hebrew congregation. For those who say that he didn't know his Bible, he certainly knew it when he was writing this letter to this Jewish congregation. The reason I pull out this quote is because today, Mark, in some contexts, some of the left-leaning states and left-leaning cities have actually been bigoted and you towards Christians, those who have a biblical sexual ethic and understanding of man-woman marriage, they've used the force of law to coerce and to bully. I think of, for example, like a Jack Phillips, the cake baker in Colorado, who was asked to bake a same-sex wedding cake and then eventually a transgender reveal cake. And he's just been dragged through the court system there. But there's other examples of Christians that are truly trying to do their work and live out their faith in a public way. How would you address, or where do we go with this? Obviously, these local governments and these state governments weren't aware of what Washington said here or what the founding fathers meant to use the coercive power of the state to bully those that had a different view and different religious convictions. Are these just outliers, by the way, these examples, the Jack Phillips, the Baronelle Stutzmans, the other Christian creative artists who are out there working? Are these outliers, or is this is this where America's heading towards increased coercive power from the government? If you have religious views, deep Christian convictions, especially in areas of human sexuality, is that the trend for the future?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'll get to the present day, but let me first highlight the letter you're talking about. George Washington to the Hebrew congregation in Newport, Rhode Island, 1790. Remember, there's only 1,500 Jews in America. They don't have economic power. They don't have political power. Washington doesn't need to cultivate this constituency. And yet he makes it clear to this tiny religious minority. There's a line you quoted, one of my favorites. There's another, "It is now no longer that we speak of toleration. All Americans have a right to act upon their religious convictions." I'm paraphrasing there, but this is very important. So progressives beginning in the 21st century started talking about freedom of worship. What goes on in the church, the mosque, or the synagogue is protected. But if you bring your faith into the public square like a Jack Phillips does, watch out. We might come to get you. So Jack Phillips is attempting to run his bakery according to his religious convictions. And so there's certain things he won't do, some of which I don't really agree with, right? He won't bake a Halloween cake. He won't bake a cake with alcohol in it. He won't bake a cake celebrating a divorce because he thinks all these things ought not to be celebrated. He won't bake a cake to celebrate a same-sex wedding ceremony either. Ironically, when a suit was brought against him, same-sex marriage was not legally recognized in Colorado. But a couple went off to Massachusetts where it was legal, then came back, demanded this cake. He said, "I'm sorry, you can buy anything in my shop. So it's not a matter of selling to you. It's a matter of using my creative talents to custom design a cake to celebrate something that I believe is wrong." So to my way of thinking, and I think to many of the founders, his ability to act upon his religious convictions ought to be protected, just like the ability of a religious pacifist not to be forced to serve in the military, just like the ability of a Native American to use peyote in a religious ceremony, even though peyote is an illegal drug. So what we're looking at here, the problem is almost no law actually targets religion. We're talking about general laws, neutral laws of general applicability. So Colorado has a statute saying you can't discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. So to my way of thinking, what we need to do, what should be done, the proper thing to do, what I think is required by the First Amendment, is to give Jack Phillips an accommodation to say, we'll leave that law in place. It might be flawed for a variety of reasons, but we aren't going to strike the whole law down. But we're going to say someone like a Jack Phillips who can't do this act will be protected. He won't have to do it. We won't force him to go against his conscience. I think you mentioned recently there's a bill going through the Kentucky legislature aimed at protecting the consciences of medical professionals, such that if a doctor or a nurse says, I have religious convictions that keep me from participating in an abortion or sterilization or providing contraception, that they ought not to be forced to do that. We already have some of those protections at the federal level, but it's useful to have them in other areas at the state level as well. So one of the jobs I have is I'm director of a project called Religious Liberty in the States. And what we do is we look at 39 distinct ways that states can choose to protect or not to protect religious liberty. In other words, the ability to act according to one's conviction isn't protected already by the First Amendment or by federal legislation. So this is a project just in its third year, and we've already identified 39 distinct ways in which religious liberty could be protected or not by various states. And so as I track this sort of thing, you're exactly right. Jack Phillips is not an isolated example. There are threats to religious liberty everywhere, and they aren't always in blue states. You see them in red states as well. You know, the sort of liberty threatened, the ability to act on certain things varies from state to state, but it's a problem, and we need to be vigilant. And let me just real quickly put in a plug for Christian legal advocacy groups like First Liberty, Alliance Defending Freedom, the Beckett Fund. These are the organizations at the front lines of protecting religious liberty, and they're very worthy of our support.
They are, and they've been very effective, if I could add. They are winning most of the religious freedom cases that they bring to the federal courts. They're winning. If you look at the trend in the last 10 years, even though state laws and local laws may coerce and violate religious freedoms of people like Jack Phillips, when they are challenged and brought to courts, we're actually doing pretty well at the federal level, including all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. So that's encouraging as well.
It is. And let me mention real quickly, sometimes people on the left say these groups are just interested in protecting Christians. That's completely false. So the top 10 Christian legal advocacy groups, literally every one of them has represented or filed briefs on behalf of religious minorities, with one exception, the Thomas More Law Center. But ADF, First Liberty, Christian, they're doing this all the time. So they care, they have a principled commitment to religious liberty for all Americans.
Mark, we are running out of time. I want to close with one last topic here, and that's the idea that religion should be welcomed into the public square. The Founding Fathers, you argue in your book, that they did welcome religion and religious expression and religious dialogue into the public square. But this is largely not the case today, especially when we're dialoguing and discussing important issues. There's a lot of hostility. Often Christians are labeled coming out of the gate, well, you're a Christian, whatever it is, after that, nationalist, or you're bigoted. I know you've debated and you've stepped into the public arena. What is your advice for those Christians who have deep convictions when it comes to especially public morality? We think of, you know, we talked about pornography and drag performances and things like that. What's your advice to Christians as they step into the public arena, knowing that they're going to be labeled? There is hostility there. How would you advise them to proceed as they engage these issues?
Well, first of all, let me point out, I have a couple of chapters in Proclaim Liberty Throughout All the Land that highlight Christians motivated by their faith to engage in public policy for basically to further human flourishing. The abolitionist movement is most notable here. People sacrificing greatly to end the evil, horrible scourge of slavery. I don't talk about it in detail, but the civil rights movement of the mid-20th century, led by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Reverend Ralph Abernathy, and on, Christians engaging in politics to further human flourishing. We have every right to do that. I think there are questions of prudence involved. So if I'm talking to a group of progressive Christians, but they actually are Christians, I might very well make biblical arguments and theological arguments to try to sway them. If I'm talking to a group of average citizens in Portland, Oregon, I live part of the year outside of Portland, Oregon, chances are this is a very secular population that is not going to be swayed by biblical or theological arguments. And so I would engage them in ways that I think would be most effective. If we're talking about abortion, I'd bring in scientific evidence as to the development of the unborn baby. I'd make moral arguments, right? Can't we all agree that innocent human beings ought not to be killed? If you can agree with that moral premise, then now let's talk about the, you know, slightly more difficult question, although I don't think it's all that difficult. Is an unborn baby a human being? And you can then, you know, rely on DNA and heartbeats and brainwaves and hopefully, you know, quote unquote, secular evidence that would convince an audience that wouldn't be open to Christian arguments. Although I could, I certainly have a right to make biblical arguments even to that secular audience. I just wouldn't, because I wouldn't think it would be effective.
Yeah, that's good advice. Mark David Hall is the author of Did America Have a Christian Founding? And also Proclaim Liberty Throughout All the Land. Dr. Hall, it has been a joy having you on the Commonwealth Matters. I think we're going to need to have you come on again to talk about your new book on Christian nationalism. Would you be willing to do that?
I would love to do that.
Very good. And I want to thank all of you for tuning into the Commonwealth Matters. If you could do us a favor and go to your favorite podcast platform, give us a rating. That greatly helps us. And then also tell your friends about the Commonwealth Matters. That's a great way to spread the word and let others know about this important work here in the Commonwealth of Kentucky. Dr. Hall, thank you again for joining us. May God bless you and keep up the good work.
Thank you very much.